do that, we may be reaching out to, I believe, OMB here and asking if they can maybe do a presentation on those reptile bounces. Do you have an update on that?
No, I think we're waiting to hear from Ledge Finance and Ledge Legal, so this is all a discussion for maybe later in the afternoon.
Great, okay. And maybe if folks could mute their phones, and then if you can hold your questions until the end of Pat Pitney's presentation, and then we will take questions at the end there. So Ms. Pitney and Mr. Painter, if you could put yourselves on the record and proceed.
This is Pat Pitney, Director of Legislative Finance.
Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division.
And just for folks who also might be watching online, I'm sorry, Ms. Pitney, your Ledge Finances have a PowerPoint presentation that I believe should be available online. And let's see, Pat or Alexi, do you know, would it just be a matter of going to the Alaska Legislature webpage and then the link from there would be to go where?
It would be the link to this House Finance meeting and in the documents section.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, go ahead and start fire away then.
So for those online, I'm on starting on page 2 of the PowerPoint. This is just a quick outline of what we're going to be talking about. We'll update on fiscal year 20 and 21 fiscal outlook, looking at the spring forecast, updated fiscal summary, any outstanding items that we think are going to come at us this year. What does that look like for 22? And then just a bit on the longer-term outlook, and then go into a little bit about the CARES Act and some of the funding coming through. In terms of, I think we'll pick up on the RPO at the very end and just do a quick summary of what's there. We haven't had the chance to analyze it yet, so we'll be brief on that package or summary of that package.
And I just want to recognize that we also have Representative Sullivan Leonard with us. Please proceed.
So moving on to page 3, so we got the spring forecast on April 6th. It assumed a fiscal year 20 average of $51.65. That for fiscal year 20, that's down from what was a $63 expectation from the fall. Moving into 21, their price estimate is $37 a barrel. There were only minimal changes on the production forecast, and the spring forecast used the permanent funds low scenario at that time, which is an ending balance of $63 billion, down from the $66 billion of last year. There were a few non-petroleum forecast updates, but they were minor and not changed as quickly as our environment, our volatile environment, is changing. So page 4 shows the price differences, and kind of the bottom line here is look at fiscal year 21 and fiscal year 22. We're down, our price estimates are down $20 a barrel. Again, and then production is only down a slight amount, 4,000 barrels versus 2,000 barrels. So we believe that both the price estimate and the production estimates could be very optimistic, and especially as what we've seen just in the last couple of days, and we'll go into that in more detail. Moving on to page 5, this shows a comparison from the fall to the spring in terms of revenue. And the third line is, see, the petroleum revenue and you have the fall and the spring, and then you have a difference. Our bottom line for petroleum revenue, we're down for 21, $693 million. 22 projected, $600 million. Non-petroleum revenue, that's then looking at fiscal year 21, $121 million down in 21 and $90 million down in 22. The next category, our percent of market value revenue, for 21, that's stable. It's stable because it's using a lagging five-year average of the permanent fund value. We don't see reductions in our POMV revenue until fiscal year 22 at $47 million and then fiscal year 23 at $98 million. That peak, if we just have this one market disruption and we return back to 7% earnings, the reduction after the five-year lagging average works its way in, we will have a $300 million difference from projected revenue from POMV to the current revenue. But as you can see, it phases in over time. But that impact is $300 million. So then dropping down to total revenue difference, we have $815 million, $814.7 precisely, as our estimate. And estimates are not precise, but that less dollars in fiscal year 21 than we expected from the fall forecast. In fiscal year 22, that's $741 million difference. So now let's start building in our cost scenarios onto that. I'm on page 6, and you see a graph. And the red line of the graph was the fall forecast. And then the yellow line is the spring forecast. And you can see that our current projected revenue and our out-year projected revenue has dropped significantly. And our expenses for fiscal year 20, the total budget ended up being $5.8 billion in unrestricted general funds. And fiscal year 21, $5.15 billion. And we probably are not done with capital and supplementals in total for fiscal year 21. So you can see our cost structure is well above that yellow line. It's above the red line, but it's well above the yellow line. $815 million less in this coming up fiscal year, and in the out years, anywhere between $650 and $750 million less every year. So I wanted to kind of show this next slide. I'm on page 7 to show the difference in our revenue picture over the past 10 years. To look at FY 2012, our revenue brought in nearly $10 billion, $9.5 billion in traditional revenue. The blue is the oil revenue, and the red is our non-petroleum revenue. Non-petroleum revenue is things like alcohol tax, tobacco tax, motor fuels tax, DMV residual fees, things like that. But it makes corporate income tax that's not associated with oil, so like the tourism corporate income tax. As you can see, the red line has been relatively stable. We've had this massive decline in the oil revenue. So we're at less than $2 billion in total projected. Actually, we're like at $1.5 billion in total projected traditional revenue, down from what was $9.5 billion. So moving on to graph 8, this lays on top the earnings reserve, our use of the permanent fund earnings over this time period. So you can see in fiscal year 2012 through fiscal year 2018, that green line, that's the amount of earnings, permanent fund earnings, that has been spent on the dividend. Moving to fiscal year 19, you see the purple bar. That purple bar shows the percent of market value revenue adding to our previous traditional oil revenue and other revenue. So in total, that brings us up to just over $4 billion. But of that over $4 billion, $3.1 billion is accounted for by our percent of market value draw from the permanent fund. So the percent of market value draw from the permanent fund now is our vast majority of annual revenue to the state budget. Oil is less than a quarter of the funding necessary for our annual budget, where back in the prior to 2013, it was over 100% of our budget requirement, and always in the area of 80 to 95% traditionally since the mid-80s. Now we're at less than a quarter. That traditional revenue stream is gone, and with the price with the price volatility and the uncertainty that this demand drop from the coronavirus has brought, that less than a quarter of our revenue stream and our budget needs from oil is probably something we need to get used to. So moving on to page 9, as I mentioned, we feel like the spring forecast, especially with the volatility that we're seeing now, could be very optimistic on both price and production. The price collapse this week is unprecedented, and I'm going to push kind of an explanation of the oil price drop and kind of our oil environment to Alexi to explain. So I'm going to turn it over to Alexi for a minute for page 9 and 10.
For the record, again, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance. So because of both the direct impacts of COVID on drilling activities and also the low prices, we've seen some companies announcing reductions in investments and rigs not being used as they have in the past, and that's going to result in less production in the short term, and more significantly is the long-term impact of that. We don't really know when those rigs might come back, but the spring forecast didn't factor in the loss of those rigs. And normally we'd say the loss of investment might lead to some additional revenue, but because the price is so low, the companies will be paying the minimum tax regardless. So that won't result in additional revenue. Turning to slide 10, just a couple of notes on the extreme low prices we've been seeing this week. So a couple of days ago, there were a lot of headlines about oil prices going negative. That was primarily driven by activity in the futures market. It was a paper negative. It was not actual oil necessarily being traded for a negative value. And in the price yesterday of ANS went back all the way up to $9 a barrel, so it was in the positive. But I think, you know, there's a few important things to realize even with, say, $9 a barrel. $9 does not even cover the cost of getting the oil from the North Slope to the market. That cost is just under $10. So at $10 a barrel, that's where only transportation costs are covered. $25 a barrel, some of the large fields are going to break even on just their operating expenditures. However, that's not enough to pay for the capital expenditures. The break even for all oil company spending is generally around $40 in Alaska. So even at the forecast price of $37, which would be a substantial increase from where we are, the companies are losing money. The FY20 budget would be balanced at about $79 oil. The FY21 budget that we have so far would be balanced at about $69 oil. So again, that's assuming the production level in the spring forecast. If companies choose to make different investment decisions or choose to further throttle back production to try to support a higher price, that could result in even less revenue, even if prices do recover. And I'll turn it back over to Pat unless there's questions for me on that.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. This is Rep. Wall.
Maybe actually if we could, I think we've just got a few more slides if we could get through, and then we'll take questions.
Okay, so I'm going to take it up on page 11. So we've really condensed the fiscal summary here, and we have available on our website the short fiscal summary and the budget summary if you want more detail. But what we wanted to do was just lead up to how we were using our remaining CBR. So our revenue picture for fiscal year 20 now is at around $4.5 billion. The budget that was passed by the legislature last year at this time, or last summer, was $5.47 billion. During the course of this legislative session, there were supplementals of $399 million passed, for a total spend in fiscal year 20 on the unrestricted general fund side of $5.87 billion. So our draw from the SBR and CBR for the fiscal year we're sitting in was $1.3 billion. That was the deficit that we made up using the CBR and the SBR. In 21, our revenue is projected to go down. Again, that's on the spring forecast, which we believe is probably optimistic. Revenue is going down with an estimate of $4.2 billion. We passed $5.15 billion of spending. Without any supplementals, the deficit draw will be $968 million. So nearly $1 billion deficit draw. So our tool that we've been able to use to make up these deficits has been the Constitutional Budget Reserve. That tool, during the fiscal year 21, will be eliminated as our deficit draw tool. So if you look on page 12, and these numbers have been revised for, we have the audited financial statements that came in, and so we were able to revise these to be more precise with the ending fiscal year 2019 balance. So the starting balance of the CBR is $2.3 billion. Deposits are estimated at $268 million. We drew from the CBR $1.14 billion. Now, we also used $172 million of the SBR. That makes up that total $1.3 billion deficit. Ending balance of the CBR for fiscal year 20 is $1.4 billion. Starting in 21, you see a much smaller estimated deposits and earnings. Earnings level is probably going to be much lower. We have the draw of $968 million, and the reason that all of it's coming from the CBR is that SBR has been completely depleted last year. That leaves $537 million in the CBR. Now, the CBR balance, that 2.2 starting balance for fiscal year 20, includes $464 million of short-term borrowing. This is money held in the general fund and is used for short-term cash flow. And we've talked about this a lot during the budgeting process, that the CBR is the state's main cash flow tool. And it's been consistently, they've been using about $500 million of the CBR for cash flow. If you exclude this short-term cash flow borrowing, the ending balance of the CBR is $72.5 million at the end of fiscal year 21, which means that it, you know, except for cash flow borrowing, it is empty. And if, and you have to figure out another mechanism for cash flow borrowing, which we'll go into a little bit further down the road. The governor's fiscal summary showed a $61.5 billion or million-dollar balance at the end of fiscal year 21. And we have reconciled with OMB, if you account for the short-term cash flow borrowing and a few adjustments, the 70, we've agreed on the 72.5. And this is miscellaneous offsetting adjustments, both on revenue carry forward and cost changes. So that 72.5 million does correspond with what OMB will show in future fiscal summaries. And it's just how you, do you account for the short-term borrowing. Moving on to page 13. For fiscal year 21, there are likely spending items that are that haven't yet been considered. We passed an incomplete capital budget, or the legislature passed an incomplete capital budget. The requests included $172 million of projects that are not included in House Bill 205. Of that $172 million, $35 million were unrestricted general fund projects. And there are things like deferred maintenance and construction, major maintenance, that weren't included. So also that hit last year was the fire suppression funding, and we could anticipate probably some COVID-type related funding issues. Both of those would land as supplementals that we would see, you know, probably in January of next year. Another kind of significant item that was not funded was the $55 million for tax credits, debt service, and so that $55 million is a cost for the tax credit funding, not through the appropriation subject to appropriation debt. Either way, something in the order of 55, or if we were following the formula, over 100 million for oil tax credits are outstanding. Additionally, the governor vetoed $210 million, mostly funding to communities. To the degree that the federal funds cover that cost, that's a one-time fix, and then those costs will show back up in fiscal year 22. So we'll jump into the outlook for fiscal year 22. So the CBR is functionally empty. If we want to continue it as a short-term cash flow mechanism, and even if we don't use it, it certainly isn't robust enough to cover an entire year. Cash flow can be made up with funds other than the CBR. You could use other designated funds as your primary borrowing mechanism, or you could use revenue anticipation notes. And those are not uncommon. But regardless, you have to figure out cash flow. But the most we would have at the end of the fiscal year is $500 million if there's no supplementals. And chances are that with the optimistic spring forecast, that $500 million may not even be available. So with the oil tax credits, with the community funding, it will be very difficult to keep the fiscal year 22 budget at the level that we currently have for the fiscal year 21. So just a little bit about, all right, let's look at fiscal year 22. If we were looking at fiscal year 21 budget, leave it flat at that budget at 50% for school debt reimbursement, we have a $300 million deficit before paying a dividend. If there were a $1,000 dividend, the fiscal year 22 deficit would be $1 billion. With a statutory dividend, a single year deficit would be $2.4 billion. So without the luxury of the CBR as our essentially easy button to solve the budget deficit, we have to address the structural budget deficit soon. And that it's going to be continued budget reductions, but it's also got to be new and diversified revenue sources. Overdrawing ERA has a cost. So everybody says, well, the earnings reserve has a balance. Yes, the earnings reserve has a balance, but remember, we're using over $3 billion every year from the earnings reserve. If you overdraw the earnings reserve, for every extra $1 billion you take, the percent of market value drops $50 million annually forever. So we must think about with the percent of market value now being more than 60% of our annual revenue stream, overdrawing that has the significant consequence of that not being an annual $3 billion plus revenue stream in the future. So a longer-term outlook is kind of hard to do right now. The predictions of how the economy is going to recover and how the oil market is going to recover from this shock just makes looking out 4 and 5 and 6 years kind of an academic exercise. And really our focus is on the short term. And, of course, with the COVID issues, you know, paying attention to the crisis and being able to recover from this crisis as quickly as possible as an overall state economy outside of the oil world with the tourism and fishing and other local businesses is probably much more front and center to the issues at hand. And then looking at your short-term and long-term ability to limit expenses and look for new revenue streams that are diversified. And kind of a final note, changing the dividend formula is not enough to close the structural budget deficit. We have statutes for expenditures. We have statutes for revenue. The number of statutes that we have that drive expenditures well exceed the statutes that we have that accommodate revenue inflow. And the statutory structural deficit that we have is a must to address to get to a structurally balanced budget. And I think that structurally balanced budget has to be addressed in the very near term because we no longer have the luxury of the CBR. So kind of enough of the fiscal outlook, and looking into some of the brighter news of the federal funding that's coming into the state. As you recall, last week we went over kind of the money that was coming in from the CARES Act, and there were two previous federal funding mechanisms before that, and there is another federal budget that was just passed by the Senate that accommodated another $500 million. So with that, I'm not going to repeat all of what we talked about last week, but with that amount of money, what we're seeing is the funds flow into tribes. We've received airport funding of $124 million. We've received healthcare funding of $16 million. The stimulus checks are starting to show up. We had $922 million in small business paycheck protection program funding for in-state areas. The Medicaid funding has been increased with an FMAP increase for 6 percentage points. So essentially the federal government is increasing their match to our Medicaid, reducing some of the state required match for that. We've gotten the public health funds. There are smaller things like the community development block grant and community services development block grant. Those are about $2.8 million is the estimate for those. Last night, the governor submitted his request for use of the CARES Act funding, and those requests included $562 million for direct municipal relief, $300 million to small businesses, $50 million for nonprofits, and $337 million to hold in for public health. There were other items outside, and that accounts for the 1.25. There were other requests for funding, $48 million for education. Much of that is passed through a school formula funding, child nutrition formula, National Endowment for the Arts. Then there's federal transit grants, which is $29 million, and then the federal aviation grants are out there. Commerce, there's a part of the CARES Act, actually this is part of the 1.25, it's $100 million focused on fisheries. There's a request from the governor to accept Department of Justice Bryn J grant of $3.6 million, and this is out of an $850 million nationwide grant program. Then the University of Alaska actually will get about $7.9 million, but they have sufficient receipt authority for some of it, and then they're requesting the remaining receipt authority of $50 million. So there's other money coming in to the international airport system, and that's $32 million. And the airport system, international airport system, has sufficient federal authority for that. And the community block grants I addressed earlier also has available authority. So the other areas we have available authority is the unemployment insurance, and those insurance payments are moving out to unemployed workers now as we speak. So the governor's requests, many of them are programs that didn't have federal receipt authority in the past, and many of the governor's requests require an appropriation rather than an RPL, and the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee is an interim committee, and the legislature is still in session. Thus, an appropriation bill for these items is a more appropriate path to getting these funds out to communities. With that concludes my presentation, and I'm available to take questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Pitney. And I just want to mention again that the governor submitted his plan for spending the $1.25 billion yesterday via the RPL process, and we will be reaching out to OMB to see if we can get a summary of that. And also I'd like to recognize that we were joined at the very start by Speaker Representative Edgman from Dillingham, and also here in the audience we've got Senator Olson, so I just want to recognize both of them. And we'll move on to questions. Representative Wool, you had a question going back to the, I believe it was something that Alexi Painter was referring to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. His question was answered inadvertently. But since I have the floor, I might as well ask another question. It was the forecast for FY22. And I know with the FY21 oil price projection is 37. What's the projected price for 22? I'm sure it's going to be – I guess projections are pretty meaningless.
Yeah, the projection for 22 is on page – I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Wolf. The projection for 22 is on page 4, and it's $41 is the projected price for fiscal year 22.
I missed that. Okay. All right, just curious because they have the revenue forecast. And I guess also of note, it's interesting, as you pointed out, that the non-petroleum revenue has stayed pretty constant since FY12, even though the petroleum revenue has, for the most part, taken a serious hit. But I guess we'll probably have to address.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Wohl, did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Next, we've got Representative Johnston and then Representative Josephson.
Yes. Thank you, to the Chair. I have two questions. On page 12, you said that for our cash flow needs, is $465 million. And I guess my concern is, and this might be a better question for Treasury, but since we're having, I mean, the federal tax delay could maybe have an effect on our cash flow. And of course, our payments, our other revenues. Do you think this $465 million is going to be adequate as far as cash flow, or do you think we're probably going to go beyond that just to get us to July 1st?
Yeah, through the Chair, Representative Johnston, that I would not at all be surprised that that short-term borrowing number is higher at the end of fiscal year 20 than it was at the end of fiscal year 19. There are some mitigating factors, but it wouldn't surprise me, but it would just be a clear guess. And the unfortunate thing is we know that short-term borrowing number once the financial statements come out, so it's kind of a delayed figure. We don't know it until late in the fall.
Okay, thank you. And then on page 14, back again to the cash flow, and other governments have the ability, and even with the CARES Act, or actually it's the Federal Reserve now, is saying that they will back tax anticipation notes with 0% interest because the municipal bond market was in such disarray. And I think that would go for state governments. But with us, as far as a revenue anticipation note, I would have concerns what revenue we could do our anticipation notes on, because it would seem that really the bulk of our revenue is coming from our permanent fund. So, I mean, do you see, and again, this might be more of a question for Treasury, but I would have concerns about the state being able to do revenue anticipation notes.
Through the Chair, Representative Johnston, whether it's revenue anticipation notes or any other debt instrument, with our structural budget deficit, and truly structural deficit, there are so many statutes that drive expenditures compared to the statutes that drive revenue, that we are in a true structural imbalance, and the credit rating agencies have noticed this, and we've been downgraded again last week. But until we have a structurally balanced budget, debt instruments are going to be difficult and will be paying a premium to get them.
And I guess in a follow-up to that, my concern would be even if we were willing to pay a premium for the debt service, I'm concerned what kind of debt service we could do just because our revenue is, revenue structure is so weak right now. Thank you.
Representative, Representative Josephson?
Yes, and tell me if you can't hear me adequately.
We can hear you great, sir. Andy.
Okay. So just a few questions on the PowerPoint itself. At page five shows POMB revenue, and we've heard and heard again this morning that we should expect, I assume largely because of the Dow Jones and the recession, a $300 million reduction in our draw, and that's not reflected in the PowerPoint. Can you sort of elaborate on that again?
Correct. So through the chair, Representative Josephson, if you look at the on page five, the POMB revenue section.
Yes.
So FY21, we're projecting the same against that five-year lagging average. So the first year this drop in the market reflects itself in the change in the POMB value is in fiscal year 22. So fiscal year 22, there's a $47 million reduction. Fiscal year 23 is 98. If you extended this table out, fiscal year 24 would be about $150 million. And by the time you get to fiscal year 27, you're at $300 million less.
Got it. Thank you. Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
My next question was really more of a comment. At page 10, I know enough about oil taxation to be dangerous, and I would say these numbers are sort of rough because there are so many variables contingent on whether, on what field you're talking about. It's principally a matter of geography, but also the royalty contract and things of that sort. But that was just a comment. My next question is about page 13. Why have we also heard the number, through the chair, Ms. Pitney, why have we also heard the number 260 million vetoes being bandied about? You show 210, but I've heard this 260.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it might be that we only counted the 205 vetoes, and there were also vetoes in 234, and then there was also a veto, and there was vetoes in the supplemental bill of 234.
Okay.
And so maybe it's the vetoes that are effective only for 21.
Okay, and famous last words, follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up?
And I know, I apologize, but I ask for your indulgence. If the $260 million of vetoed monies are sustained, that is, the governor's promise to supplant most, and I think that was the key word is most of the money, with federal resources, and there's no effort to reappropriate, there's no opportunity to override, et cetera, where does that money stay? In other words, theoretically, we're $260 million richer, and where would I find those dollars?
So you find it in the balance of the CBR, because we're already drawing $968 million to cover the existing expenses that takes into account the vetoes.
Okay.
So the CBR value, we would be working into the cash balance amount, or the cash flow amount of the CBR, if those vetoes had not happened.
Okay, and I guess my next question, and I've debated whether to, you know, I want to say this very sensitively because I'm very attuned to what's happening to our sister states. There were, I think, 474 people yesterday that died, principally in the New York City, five boroughs of the New York City. But assuming that, and mind you, our track record in Alaska of people dying in the Spanish influenza was a bad one. a very bad one, particularly in our native communities. So we don't know what's coming, but the Congress is being very, very generous. And I say this with the greatest sensitivity, because no one would wish any of this on anyone. But I guess I'm seeing a lot of money. I mean, for example, the governor wants to pay my city $156 million. And I don't think the government of Anchorage, not the people, the government of Anchorage has suffered that sort of impact yet. So I guess what I'm wondering is this going to be sort of a windfall? Assuming that we keep our disease rate down and our death rate down, and I ask this only in an Alaska specific scenario.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the funding, the impacts of the economic situation, the impacts of the health situation are going to be different than the impacts of the resulting economic situation. Right. And what we have the opportunity, there is the opportunity to mitigate some of those larger economic impacts. And I believe it is the legislature's call to evaluate the distribution of the available funds to address the environment in the entire state.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Johnson has a comment on that?
Yes, just in follow-up, Representative Josephson, the $1.25 billion, while we're still waiting to have the final version from the Secretary of Treasury as far as the sidebars on that funding, the governor has followed through on the legislative intent, and that was that 45% of those funds were to go to the communities. And in that first CARES Act, communities with $500 million or more would directly apply to the federal government, and the federal government would be responsible to manage those funds to those larger communities or up to $500,000. State of Alaska does not have any community that large, so now it's up to the state to disperse and manage the funds, and the governor last night, you know, released his approach to that, and I will say that it was with full acknowledgement that 45% of the funds were to go to the local governments or local communities.
I'd like to recognize that we're also joined by Representative Mark Clayman here in the audience.
Rep. Carpenter, and I'd like to
I have a question as well.
Representative Carpenter, and then Representative Ortiz. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. This question is regarding slide 10, and it's for Alexi Painter. If he could speak to his analysis, what happens when production is curtailed? I have it on very good authority that we are days away from a slowdown in production, and if the economy doesn't pick up nationwide to grow demand for fuel products, then we're looking at somewhere of a complete shutdown within the next 90 days, probably as soon as June-July timeframe. So I see that you're making analysis here based on an average values, and if we went to zero, the price of oil went to zero, we would still have a nearly $46 average, but what happens to our revenue when production is severely curtailed?
through the chair, Representative Carpenter. So of that petroleum revenue, really the only thing that would be relatively unaffected by that would be the property tax, because that value would not drop that quickly, but that would have a severe impact to the minimal production tax we're still getting, as well as the royalty share. So, you know, the scenarios that the Department of Revenue provided were their low production scenario. That only goes down to 416,000 barrels in FY21, so nowhere close to zero. And I think exploring what would happen in those extreme scenarios is worth doing, but at this point, we don't have the data about what the precise impacts could be.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up?
And nor will you have the data, because we will all experience it at the time that it happens. This is unprecedented. But we are looking at max capacity of all of our storage across the world, around the world. And if my sources are correct, we're going to see the pipeline pretty close to shut down. Production will have to come to a halt because we don't have the capacity for storage. And if we are not factoring in some scenario, that, regardless of what Department of Revenue says, that doesn't take into account, or that takes into account, that production is going to come to a halt if we can't get this economy going again. And this is not just Alaska economy. This is demand across the nation. Alaska is not going to be able to create the demand necessary. Our economy cannot create the demand necessary to make the dent that we would need to in the production or the storage. So if we don't account for that somehow, if we aren't thinking through that somehow, regardless of what revenue is thinking, then we're doing ourselves a disservice, because these numbers are just pie in the sky. So I would be interested to see what a projection would look like if we had a 50% reduction in throughput. What would that do to our revenue? And then, I mean, maybe it's incrementally every quarter percent or 25, 50, 75% reduction in throughput, just to see what that does to our revenue. Because I think that's plausible. It's not just possible, it's plausible. I have a second question on slide 17 for Ms. Pitney. The $465 million short-term borrowing that's used for cash flow, does that get repaid as revenue comes in automatically, or is that $465 spent and it's gone, and then we would have to reappropriate a like kind the following year, or you would have to take out short-term borrowing for the following year for cash flow?
So, through the chair, Representative Carpenter, you'd have either short-term borrowing or borrowing from another fund source if you didn't use the CBR. And the CBR technically should be paid back at the end of each year, and the full CBR balance should show, but they don't true up. They don't do the accounting to true it up at the end of the year. So technically, from an appropriation standpoint, that $464 million is available. It's just been consistently used. So unless you replace it with a different short-term borrowing mechanism, then it needs to be saved. And then the short-term borrowing mechanism, especially if it were like a revenue anticipation notes, would require an appropriation.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I think what I understand is that the dollars that we're going to be using for cash flow will be gone at the end of the budget year, because they will be spent. They're not coming back in as revenue is achieved. It is something that would have to be dealt with the following fiscal year. It is money spent.
It through the chair, it is an appropriation issue that would have to be accommodated in the following year. That is true.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Painter, would you be able to provide us with some modeling different scenarios for various production levels. The point that Representative Carpenter made, if you were to show production at, say, 50% and just various levels, is that something you could provide to the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I can work with the Department of Revenue to figure out what scenarios they can provide. When we get to these very low production levels, then the transportation cost gets spread over fewer and fewer barrels, so it's kind of difficult for us to just guess at that, but the Department of Revenue can model that, and I will work with them to provide something for the committee.
Great, thank you. And next question, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. The first one is quick. Going to page 6 on the FY21 projected budget of $5.15 billion, does that include the governor's vetoes, or is that number not include the governor's vetoes?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that number includes the vetoes. So if the vetoes were restored, that number would be higher.
Okay, thank you for that. Second question I have relates to the governor's vetoes. And am I correct in understanding that, for example, the $30 million for education that was vetoed by the governor, is the verdict still out on the question as to whether or not CARES Act monies or the $1.25 billion monies can be used to supplant that reduction of the $30 million? And the second question of that is, if the verdict is not out, will there be strings attached to how that potential education money could be used, federal strings attached to that particular amount of money, the $30 million? That's my question. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the a provision in the CARES Act provides for $38 million for education stabilization, and that money is the request of the governor and the sideboards of the federal money have that being distributed based on the foundation formula. I don't know if there's additional sidebars on the use of the funds, but there is in the governor's request and part of the CARES Act, $38 million to be distributed to schools. I don't know the additional sidebars on once it gets to the schools.
Representative Johnson has a comment on that?
Yes, just a follow-up to that. I've spoken with Bede, and it seems that the funding formula for these funds are tied with the Title I schools or Title I population, and Bede has so far been working hard to get a number of exemptions as far as what it can be used for, being very rural. One of the exemptions I know has been on the broadband. So I think while it's a funding formula, a federal funding formula, and it's tied to Title I, our Department of Education is working very hard to make sure that it gets used to the best to work through the education system right now.
Thank you.
Further?
Thank you for that. I have no further questions.
Sure. Representative Ortiz?
Mr. Chairman?
Is that Representative Sullivan-Leonard?
It is.
Okay.
May I ask a question, or am I in the queue?
Let's see, Representative Ortiz, did you have a follow-up?
No, I don't, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm done with my questions at this point. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Sullivan Lennon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a quick question with regard to slide 15. As we're looking at the first bullet point and talking about what our outlook is for FY22 based on a flat budget, my question is such, what is it for oil price if we looked at a flat budget and then compare that to what we realistically would be looking at for revenue, maybe on the average of about 25 to 30 per barrel? I guess what I want to hear is, you know, we can talk about a flat budget, but I really want to kind of hear realistically what the budget may look like with the true numbers.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, the fiscal year 22 spring forecast for oil from the Department of Revenue was $41. So if you drop down to $25 to $30 a barrel, that that deficit, rather than being $300 million, could grow to $600 to $700 million.
Thank you, Pat, and that's what I'm looking at. As we're talking about revenue, what we're missing in this discussion is truly the operating costs and our expenditures. And, you know, I can't see moving forward at looking at a flat budget. Realistically speaking, even economists are saying that prices will maybe be 20 a barrel if we're lucky. Can we get some modeling then that shows truly what the realistic forecast may look like for our budget in the sense of what we can afford and what we can't?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I think that's the task that we've just been getting in terms of looking at lower production scenarios, and we will add the lower price scenarios in as well.
You bet. And then just if I could make a quick comment, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sure we're sending some money.
Thank you. My hopes, too, are that leadership can sit down and truly have a chance to talk about a fiscal plan and have that discussion with the administration and with OMB, with what's happening across the globe and, of course, for us here in the state. A true fiscal plan is most necessary at this time, and, you know, everything needs to be on the table for that discussion. We can talk about revenue all day long, but we truly have to talk about our fiscal situation in the sense of a realistic budget and how we're moving forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions?
I do, Mr. Chairman. One for Pat Pitney. This is Representative Carpenter.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am curious if she would expound upon her opinion why a bill is more appropriate than the RPL process for dealing with the, what was the last slide there, was additional funds to be appropriated. Is there a regulation or a rule or a law that is your opinion for that, or is this a something else?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think that Megan Wallace would be the most best person to provide her legal analysis. But based on the legal analysis from Megan, the items that are in the RPL have traditionally and currently have no federal receipt authority attached to them. And so this isn't merely increasing federal receipt authority. This is adding an entirely new appropriation. So the RPL process isn't appropriate for that. And the RPL process is traditionally used when the legislature is not in session. But to get a much more robust legal assessment of that, Megan Wallace would be more appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Pitney. I can follow up with her. I was just curious where you were getting your foundation from. Thank you.
Do we have any further questions?
Mr. Chair, this is Ruff Wolf. Can I jump in?
Representative Wolf.
you. I think I heard Alexei Painter say, but I just want to ask him to either say it again or make sure I heard it correctly. But regarding the oil taxes and oil tax initiative, I heard him say that at these prices we're already at the minimum, and so that, for example, I know a lot of people are looking to the initiative to kind of save the day with the extra $1 billion coming in. But even for legacy fields, is it correct that at these low prices the initiative would not raise much money? Can you clarify that?
Representative Wolf, through the chair. So the current minimum tax is 4% of gross. The initiative, one of the aspects would be to raise that to 10%. So, you know, if the forecast for production tax in FY21 is $122 million based on the 4%, if that got bumped up to 10%, then you'd get $250 to $300 million instead. So there would be an increase, but it would not be on the order of $1 billion.
Thank you. Thanks for that clarification. And I guess alluding to the points brought up by Representative Carpenter and Representative Sullivan Leonard, I guess this points out the brilliance of Jay Hammond by creating the permanent fund. So for the day when oil drops deeply, like it is, and the future is, we still have a reliable the permanent fund has to adjust our budget and or revenue sources accordingly. But thank you.
Do we have any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, one last question, if I may, Rep. Carpenter.
Sure, Representative Carpenter.
Yeah, I'm just curious, before I arrived to the legislature, I understand that the RPL process was used to expand Medicaid in 2015. And I'm just curious if that was a similar situation or is there a did we have authority to expand it then? Or what is the difference between then and now?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, Medicaid is traditionally a federally funded program. And so this was adding federal funding to an already adding an increased federal amount to an already federally funded program. So some things are adding federal, like, for instance, education has federal grant funding that flows through it. So some things have existing federal lines. The community services block grants have federal lines that flow through. But again, the RPL process is an out of session, is a interim mechanism as well.
And a follow-up to that then, it would be helpful for me to understand which line items, and maybe this is something that can be produced by somebody there, which lines aren't or don't have normally federally funded lines to them, just to highlight what we're dealing with here. Because it's a little confusing.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that is on our list.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Justin?
Yes, and not that we're going to resolve the debate we've been having now since 2016 this morning, but Ms. Pitney, through the chair, Ms. Pitney, you said that as the numbers stand today, if in FY22 we paid a $1,000 PFD, our deficit would be $1 billion. And in the debate that I'm referring to between raising revenue, cutting government, it's likely to be both, I hope. But in this debate about whether to simply slash government, if the deficit on a $1,000 PFD is $1 billion, And we had no corrections department, which is about $400 million, and we had no university, which is, we'll round up and say $300 million. So we eliminated the university grant, eliminated jails, we'd still have a $300 million deficit. Am I right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's correct.
Thank you.
Do you have any further questions or comments? And hearing none, we'll go to wrap up. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, Chair Foster. I think we've painted quite a picture here today. I would like to say, as far as these funds that are coming from the federal government, I think the only time Alaska, since I've been here, has had a similar situation was during the Exxon Valdez. And at that point, the revenues into the state were 80% federal, so that's something that we can look at. The other thing I'd like to say, I think as legislators and as the administration, I think all of our concern is getting these federal funds to the communities and to the people as quickly as possible, because we understand that this is a very stressful time on everyone. And so I hope Representative Foster alluded to that we might ask OMB to come and explain their RPLs to us. But I hope that the ultimate goal after we've had Ledge Finance and Ledge Legal look at the RPL process, our ultimate goal will be to get the funds to the people as quickly as possible and work with the administration. And we're at the beginning process of that, and I know all of us have good intentions to make this work. Thank you.
Okay. So with that, if folks could just keep an eye out for when we might be able to have that meeting, if possible, with OMB or our Ledge Finance if as an alternative. And so with that, I don't have anything further. We will be adjourned at 11:20 a.m. Thank you, everyone.